Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 653, February 2023.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I am your host, Jason Snell, and this episode is about a movie just arrived on Disney Plus after being in theaters last year. It is Black Panther Wakanda Forever. Ryan Coogler returns to the Black Panther series. Another Marvel movie, but I would say a different. The Black Panther movies feel like a different kind of Marvel movie to me in a bunch of different ways that we'll get into. I've assembled most, not all, but most of the people who were here to talk about Black Panther way back in 2018, and then we have a sub, but that's okay because they're all great. Let me introduce them to you now. Cicero Holmes is here. I believe, Cicero, perhaps that Black Panther episode was your first episode with us, although you've been on many since. Hello, welcome back.
You know what? Thank you very much, Jason. I had 2658 encryption on when I was doing that Black Panther
and you
episode.
Lost your password. That's so, the worst part.
Yeah.
But you just have to hack yourself and get that file back. Lisa Schmeiser is also here. Hello.
Hello. I have on my suit so that the fathoms don't crush me.
That's good. You get your Abyss style environment deep dive suit on. That's good. Moises Chuyan also joins us. Hello.
I'd prefer to be addressed as Horned Serpent God.
Wouldn't we all? And Kelly Gamont is our sub, filling in for Micah, who was here the last time. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to the world of the Black Panther.
I mean, your name is cool, too, I guess.
Cool Khan. Wakanda Forever. So, okay. Ryan Coogler wrote a whole screenplay for this movie, and then we lost Chadwick Boseman. And I had this thought of like, well, I mean, are you going to keep making this movie? And they did. And he rewrote the script and he changed it. And one of the things that I think is most fascinating about this movie is how it tries. It's got to do a lot of different stuff. And one of the things it needs to do is mourn both Chadwick Boseman and T'Challa. And that's I went into it thinking like, I don't know. What are they going to do here? Right. And say what you will about the rest of the movie, and I like this movie a lot. I am so impressed with how his death is handled with care and with love, and that the movie makes space at a couple of points for the audience to mourn with the people who made the movies for the incredible talent of Chadwick Boseman, that was on such display in the original Black Panther movie. So that's the thing that is hanging over this movie from the very beginning is, what do you do and how do you do it? And how do you recognize Chadwick Boseman while also doing a giant big budget Marvel movie? And I think I just, every time I've seen it, I've thought this is the movie making space for the audience and itself to recognize him. And I think they did a very good job of it.
That leads directly into the majority of the topic of my opening statement. The scope of this story could have filled a 6-hour miniseries, but it felt better as something that was epic scale cinematic event that everybody was going out to the theater to experience, to your point about giving the audience space to mourn. And the thing that bugged me, there were lots of hot takes out there. One of the hot takes was they should have just recast him. I don't think that was fair, and not even getting to the audience, I don't think that would have been fair to the people who made the first movie and made this movie. I cannot fathom how the people who made this movie would have been able to get through making this, much less finding an actor willing to take on here, just jump in place of Chadwick Boseman. And I feel like the processing of grief, as I've dealt with processing a lot of grief myself over the last year, I think making space for it and finding that way of telling this story and giving people a way to, in some ways, not just grieve Chad Boseman, but many, many people that have been lost over the last few years. I feel like this movie helped those sorts of themes land more than a lot of the Phase 3 Endgame, so on and so forth stuff really let it hit home. It is unfortunate that it had to be the result of Chadwick Boseman's passing. But I think it's really one of the things that for me is most resonant about the movie is how artfully they were able to live their real feelings in a much realer way than actors usually do. And as a whole production, find a way to do something that otherwise would be kind of a tough sell of, okay, we're going to make a big mega budget comic book movie and it's going to be about death, dying, and grief.
Yeah.
Overwhelmingly. And it's going to be 2 hours and 40 minutes long. And it's also going to deal with incredible themes of tribal peoples being colonized and linking native peoples to, you know, from the Americas that tie in with a lot of Latinx people's background. We're doing all that in addition to making the whole movie about mourning.
It felt a lot bigger, I think, in that way. You know, we always talk about how Marvel movies have such high stakes, right? And, you know, because everything is about the universe hangs in the balance or whatever. And one of the things that I really liked about this one that sort of, and I think, hopefully anyway, Lisa will back me on this, it gave a very strong Disney Plus MCU TV show vibe in the, like, you know, once again, it could be argued that the villain here is grief and, you know, that the way that you defeat that villain is by going on and, you know, not by ignoring it at all. I mean, we get an entire hunk of film and a profound thing happens in the movie before we ever get a Marvel opening title card. You know, like we get that in there first and then from there go on to all the other stuff. And it definitely really felt like that, like, you know, the people making the movie were all having this processing, the people in the movie were all having this processing, the people watching the movie were all having to go through all this processing. And it in that way it felt a lot more profound, like you were saying, Miss S, about all of the other all of the Phase 4 stuff that we had, all of the Phase 3 stuff we had seen about Endgame and all of that. Like, this felt a lot bigger and deeper than that, and the universe did not hang in the balance at any moment in that opening reel of the movie.
You know what this movie actually did for me? Is it made the snap feel like the pandemic in a way. One of the complaints I've had about the snap, which I hasten to add, excellent, excellent narrative what if thing. Oh, what if 50% of everything just goes away? Who's left? What do you deal with it? There's a lot going on there. And how the MCU has told stories around that has been weird and a little uneven. But when I was watching this movie the first time, what struck me was this is basically the first pandemic era Marvel movie, where the grief and the randomness and the fact that somebody who is tremendously noble and helps save the world gets struck down by something we never really see that comes out of nowhere that people are powerless to do anything about. And it reverberates through a society and it disrupts everything. And people are stuck in this place of anger or grief. I was like, oh my gosh, that's basically like the last 3 years. And then when you think about how I had read an interview with Ryan Coogler where he was like, well, this movie was always going to be about grief. It was going to originally be about T'Challa's grief that he lost 5 years of his life. That people who came back after they had been snapped the world moved on without them. And there's a tremendous amount of grief there. And I was like, oh my gosh, the parallels are overwhelming. And so when I was watching this movie, I thought, you know, it's kind of the closest thing we've got to a cultural expression of pandemic grief. And it all ties back to the snap. And there's an extra layer of resonance that I don't think the movie benefits from, but I think the movie echoes and amplifies, if that makes sense.
It was weird. Nobody else was there. The only people we saw in Wakanda were Wakandans. And it was like nobody else recognized that he had passed. It was very weird to me.
I actually really love that. Because one of the things I love about Black Panther, the first movie, and that I loved about this was it's about a group of people who have a very un-Western way of looking at themselves relative to their society. These are people who put their sense of Wakanda, the nation with its centuries of history and its exceptionalism and its standards, they put that first, and and their sense of identity is tied up in how can I contribute to perpetuating and extending the legacy of Wakanda. And frankly, there's no room for Ant-Man in that. Like, Doctor Strange comes in, and hopefully a rhinoceros is there to boot his ass over a canyon. So I like what a bubble it was, you know?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I didn't expect a cameo, but, you know, I you know, not even a speaking part, but, like, maybe, you know, maybe Captain America's standing there, maybe, you know, mm-hmm. somebody that might have been. That was it. That was a thing that struck me on subsequent watchings.
One quick thing, one complaint out in the discourse was, Ironheart felt kind of shoehorned in. I like that the outsider perspective was somebody to whom Wakanda meant a lot ancestrally. And so we got a different balance of that outsider perspective than we even get from our friend Agent Ross, who is in the movie only literally as much as he needs to be.
So the one thing I want to say is that I was, you know, I wasn't excited for this film when it finally released because of everything that happened, because of Chadwick Boseman's death, because they needed to pivot. And I think I was feeling a little bit of the Marvel movie fatigue, right? So there was some malaise behind going to see this film, and I was somewhat dragging my feet until yet again my mother, who famously or at least infamously in my head, at the time when we recorded our Black Panther a podcast, had seen the movie in theater 6 times. She had gone to see this film, and on the way out of seeing this film, one of the local HBCUs had been bussed over to the theater that she was at to go see the film by Sprite, and they were playing the Wakanda theme. The band was playing music from the film. And it was it was such a moment, and, you know, people were dressed up and it reminded me yet again of why this movie was so important, why this franchise was so important. And then I went to go see the film, and it again reiterated it echoed the things that I saw in these videos outside of the theater, inside the film. These films, I said before about the Marvel films that, like, you know, the Ant-Man films are a heist films. I thought Captain Marvel was a buddy cop film. the Black Panther franchise is about colonization, right? And it's about being able to shed that skin, right? To shed that, like, that weight of being who we were culturally without the dirtiness of colonialism, right? And being able to get rid of that weight and see who we could be if those weren't the things that were motivating us, right? If colonial wishes weren't motivating us. And you got to see that in two ways, right? You got to see that from the perspective of the Wakandans, and you got to see that from the perspective of the Namor's people. I don't know what the
Talocanil. A word they never use in the movie, but the place is called Talocan, and the proper, term would be Talocanil.
Right. So these very two philosophies from similar nation states that were under, or at least had very, very similar perspectives on how they viewed the world and what they were protecting the world from because of the power that they possessed. There was a moment early in the film when they go to the UN and Angela Bassett, if Angela Bassett doesn't win an Academy Award, there's something wrong with the Academy.
There's no justice.
How long has she been due?
Right. Yes. Exactly. Like this was her training day, right? Like this was the film where, you know, and the Bear film for Leo DiCaprio, right? Like this is the film. Finally, you know, please, Academy, you got to give it to her. But when she was at the UN and she's sitting there and she's talking about, you know, we've got these weapons, but we're not worried about what we can do with them. We're worried about what you would do with them.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And because the world has shown, the Western world has shown what they do with great power. And, that's something that resonates really, really, really deeply with, people that have melanin in their skin. So it was great to see those things again broached and not kind of danced around from this film.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
I really appreciated that all through the movie. There's a very nice balance of like, oh no, this is what's happening. You know, doesn't Shuri call him my favorite colonizer at one point? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, like, and all of those things were, you know, not what we normally get from movies, let alone comic book movies.
I mean, Kelly, full credit to you for saying that the enemy of this movie is grief, but I mean, it's really the government of the United States of America. Also the French.
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah. Anyway, also the French. Just throw the French in there,
if we're going to drag the French into it, then I think the enemy is
French history in Africa is not great either. But the United States. And that's, I think, one of the things that I really loved in watching it a second time. The stuff that I really noticed is the plot is, I think, super tight. Like, I think it's a really, really, really solid plot, because the whole idea here is simply they found out about vibranium. Wakanda has it all. somebody, Riri Williams, built a detector, and they find that there is yet another hidden society that has this stuff. And so the existence of Wakanda as a public face now for the first time has called Talokan now is in grave danger, because they're another source for vibranium, and it's going to be a problem. Which I love how Talokan is built as a parallel society to Wakanda, in the sense that, again, there's a story mm-hmm. about like the there are blue things that you grow and drink and they make you super powerful and stuff. It's a different story, and yet it is, and it's a much more tragic story in that it is post-colonization and they basically are fleeing their own home into the sea, but yet it also has these mirrors with Wakanda, which I think is really great. But like the core of it is sort of that old Julia Louis-Dreyfus I enjoyed her in this, because she is the roving id of the United States government, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's like, what if Selina Meyer were really, really, really evil,
right,
and
right.
good at her job,
as opposed to just benignly evil,
like
yeah.
malicious yeah, exactly. and not just evil.
Evil
yeah.
in a very much a, well, we're America, we should have everything. And I want to point out again, this is a huge budget movie, American movie that is fundamentally saying the U.S. government is the bad guys, and it's not like the U.S. government
down with empire, comrade.
I mean, that is what this movie is really about, and I find it. Yeah. I actually think that Martin Freeman's character is fascinating because he is the good guy in this movie among the Americans, and he's literally committing treason throughout.
Yeah.
And the moment they point it out, it's like, yeah, he totally is, but he's like, but they're so good.
Yeah, he's committing treason according to the laws of one country, but he's doing it to preserve world peace.
Exactly.
Like the complex stack of intercultural, intergovernmental relations in this. For me, the thing that I loved so much about the first movie was how heavily they dove straight into the broader, richer tapestry of Wakanda that Christopher Priest's run with Marvel Knights brought to the world, bringing a layer of real anthropological thought to the way that this was set up and not just the way that it started a few decades before. And that extends to Namor has been one of my favorite Marvel characters for a long time because he does not care how bossy he is. He does not care about this. He does not care. He's Aquaman and he doesn't care who thinks he's mean, which is a much more interesting version of Aquaman. And like the layers of what they have done to enrich the Atlantean side of things, the Talokan'il, going into it when there were rumors that they were going Yucatec Mayan with it, to the best of my knowledge, my ancestry on my Cuban side goes into this tribal diaspora to some extent. And so as an anthropologist in college, this is the stuff that I studied. And when there were just rumors about it, I went, surely they won't. They won't do something that is almost just for me and feels, it gives me the feeling that those dudes in that video who were standing in front of the standee for the first movie, who were like, this is what this feels like. Mm-hmm. You guys get to feel like this all the time. What? For me, I kind of went into seeing it expecting to enjoy that, but I did not expect how deep they went with it. And aside from the geopolitical side of things, just the way that they shoot Talokan, where they let it be dark and shadowy and weird and don't overlight it. They didn't have to go this hard and they went that hard and then they went a little harder. That's what impresses me the most when you see something like this, you see something like a lot of the things that were moved ahead in Shang-Chi, moving ahead very old Marvel library things that maybe have gotten some reinvention and some reworking over the years. But I'm still baffled at what an incredible job they are doing at really make, I mean, it's almost like the people who complained that, oh, they made the Klingons too weird and diverse and everything in Discovery. I'm glad they did. Klingons are a lot more interesting being more than just, oh, we're one single samurai monoculture thing. That same kind of series of principles have been expanded on even further than Discovery did, both with Wakanda and with Talokan, which the Marvel comics have not gone anywhere near as deep in trying to recontextualize the Atlanteans as anything other than people with pointy ears.
No, and Namor is a character, for those who don't know the comics, it's been around for
like the 30s.
It's a very, very long time. Like Captain America, this is an ancient character that then got brought into the Marvel universe in the 60s. But like you refer to him as a hero, but I mean he is a hero / nemesis anti-hero kind of character. He's a fascinating, complex character, which is one of the things that I think is brilliant about using him in a movie like this, where the geopolitical history of planet Earth is the real enemy, and he is an instigator of the action of the movie. But like like Black Panther, where Killmonger, you're like, oh, he's the bad guy. Well, wait a second. He kind of is making good
Killmonger
points.
Killmonger has a point.
Lisa, Lisa's
like,
fanning
Killmonger
herself
had a point
right
in
now
this movie, too. Like,
he does. Yes. He does. He does. Yeah. And Namor has, and Namor really has, I mean, he's like, guys, you hung us out to dry. They're coming for us. Now, he, and again, in that perfect, Moises will back me up on this, I think, in that perfect Namor moment where you're like, yeah, this guy is the hero. He says, and so you're going to go get that scientist and bring them to us, or we're
or
going
I will kill
to attack you,
you.
Or we'll kill
like,
you.
Whoa, but, whoa,
or,
dude.
Or
whoa,
we'll lay waste.
Yeah.
Well, like, one of the things I love about the Black Panther movies is they show you that royalty don't mess around. Like, this is a thing that comes up. One of the things I've been struck about with both movies is if you are raised as somebody who believes you have a divine right to rule because you've got a connection to the ancestral plane through Bast, or you have a connection to like the winged serpent god thanks to the ritual that your people did to escape the colonizers, like you're 100% convinced in your bones that you get to boss everybody around. That's just how it works. And I freaking love that. I love that we see how monarchy would play out in a complicated, data-driven, we got superheroes and aliens 21st century world.
Isn't it a great moment in this movie where Namor realizes that Angela Bassett has totally played him.
Right.
Like, wait. They got her while I was with the... Right. And actually, it's his one of his people is like, oh, they called you into a meeting when they took the... And he's like, they got
robot
me.
Robot house.
This right, could have been an email.
Another queen.
Like, the way they introduce Namor as, you know, will he, won't he be an antagonist? He becomes an antagonistic force, but because of the way that they contextualize his motivations, instead of doing the easy thing, they go, no, he's a deuteragonist. We're going to make you question the protagonist-antagonist relationship in a similar way to the first movie, but through yet a different lens. And that it subtextually plays with some of these still ongoing frictions between the Latin community and the Black community going both directions. Like, this conflict isn't over. I don't think Atuma and Namora are done with Wakanda.
No, no.
And we got more than just a tease of that.
That's what I like about that scene at the end where it's sort of like, well, wow, this is bad. And he's like, no, you don't understand. Trust me, in fact, is his last line, right?
It's last thing he says.
They're going to come for Wakanda now, and then Wakanda's going to need us. Trust me. And it's such a great moment because it's like, oh boy, this guy, right?
Yeah. Like, he's a couple hundred years old. He has seen how this stuff plays out. I mean, because this is another thing you're talking about is in terms of long-lived entities in on Earth in the MCU, it's him and the Eternals, and we all know the Eternals are useless. So, like, Namor's got it locked up here.
He's been building a society underwater.
Lisa, you leave my meat robots alone.
your beautiful cloud clients.
I want to talk about the maybe we'll talk about the characters and people who are in this movie because we got some people coming back from Black Panther, and we got some new characters here. I wanted to start with Lupita Nyong'o because I love what they do with her here. You know, she's off in Haiti. Like, she's just not in Wakanda. She's like living a different life. And there's this real question of like, what went on here? Like, what went on here? And we see Angela Bassett goes there and they're like, oh, would you like to see the headmaster, the schoolmaster? And it's Lupita Nyong'o who has kept her distance. And then over time, we get the whole story, right? But it does parcel it out all the way through part of the credits. In fact, we get the whole story of what's been going on with her and her life. And this is one of those big moments of like, well, what happened because T'Challa died? Like, well, what happened? And there's like, there's the snap. And then, but he comes back, but he has since died, and she was his partner, so what is the deal? And I like that she gets called in to be the secret agent at one point. It's kind of a fun moment, too,
so
where it's like,
good.
Hey, you're sort of near where where Talokan might be. Why don't you just investigate that for a little while? And so she does that part too. But
on your way home from getting groceries, just put on this cute dress and go talk to some folks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Could you go? Yeah. Here's some glasses and just swing by. Yeah.
You know Spanish.
You know Spanish, yeah. Right? You're in the general vicinity. Can you just stop on that? And she's like, I got to get to that beach. Right. Take me to that beach. I'm going to sit there on a beach for a while. And no, I'm working. I'm looking for blue people. Okay. Just let me be here. But, and so affecting, you know, at the end, but also useful for the plot. But I like how she comes in and she's like at a remove and is not part of the action. And then you're like, oh, right. Like for me, having not just seen Black Panther, when she appears, I'm like, oh, I forgot all about that part. Oh, right. Right. Like it's like, and it all comes back in that moment.
Where the first movie was about like Black culture and you know, like the Pan-African diaspora and you know, celebrating all of that. I think this film was about celebrating all of that, but also like laser focusing on the experience of Black women, right? Like this was the movie where the women took the fore, right? Everyone
so great.
That had a moment to that was of any importance was from Wakanda was a woman and Winston Duke, right?
Yeah, and M'Baku. Also my man M'Baku.
With the side of M'Baku.
Too, but, you know, but, when, he, yeah, when needed.
Right. Winston Duke walks in with an ad lib. It wasn't ad lib, calling Okoye a bald headed
right,
demon.
Yes.
Now, we know that at some point, He and Okoye, they're going to smash. We know that, right?
I mean...
That was way too many sparks so to be anything else. Come on.
I'm wondering if it's M'Baku and Okoye or M'Baku and Shuri.
By the end, maybe.
I don't know.
I feel like Griot would actually declare his intentions first.
Yeah, I could see Shuri falling in love with her AI.
Yeah.
I knew this was going to end up being the, like, the...
The Valentine's Day special.
Taking our detour into the shipping lane for just a moment. Honestly, I think Enemies to Lovers would be amazing between M'Baku and Namora.
Oh wow!
Oh,
wow.
Oh-ho.
There's got to be some crossover between the cultures that mixes into that conflict at some point. But I don't know. I'll just leave that there. I'll just leave it
there. Well, now that the heart-shaped herb has the underwater herb mixed into it, there's stuff going on.
Okoye and Atuma go from dueling with
you got
spears.
It. There it is. Thank you very much. She's crossing. Like, yes. You know, she's got her spear, and he's got his hammerhead shark skull on his head that he wears as a hat. I mean, those two crazy kids, anything can happen.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So Lupita Nyong'o, great. Great to see Danai Gurira back. She gets fired. That's tough. That's tough stuff, setup. Right? Like the queen is
there's
like Okoye.
There's
Okoye,
a lot of that going around, you know.
You're fired, and it's like, wow, that seemed a little harsh. Like you're out. You're just completely out. You
not
lose
even
all your
a
jobs.
PIP first. Right. It's ooh,
yeah, I know. But there, not even a it wasn't a bad review. It was you're out. Yeah,
yeah. No, and she gets her redemption where she gets to wear her kind of like blue Iron Warrior angel thing.
So yeah,
later
so the
on,
min- so the Midnight
nice.
Angels, the Midnight Angels are a real thing in the Black Panther lore, but that suit and the suit is reminiscent of the suits that they wore in the comics. But all I could see when I looked at those was Power Rangers. They just look like putties.
And the name, the name is a bit much. The name is very like 80s hair metal 100%. Band ballad.
There's a lot of Aquanet involved.
That, they foregrounded how ridiculous right. they look and the name and everything. I'm glad yeah. that they just addressed that right out of the gate and then kept coming right. back to it.
Has this gotten uglier?
Yeah, that made it easier to deal with because they were saying all the things about it that
right.
I wanted to
yeah.
say.
Well, I mean, they came out with the MacGuffin suit right out the box. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you got to see it. And that was good, right? Like you said, Moises, it was good that they didn't, you know, that they steered into the swerve. and that way sure. yeah, that way it was out there. It did look silly, but it was still fun. What it did do for me that I didn't like was a thing that also happened in the first Black Panther, which was two CGI characters are fighting and you have the kinetic CGI fight. And it just like everything else looks very, very realistic. It looks like it's actually part of the world. And then yeah. you have,
and then all of a sudden, right?
And then it yeah, just yeah.
We jump in a time machine to the Killmonger T'Challa fight exactly. from the first movie that looked like rubber right. action figures yes. being slapped.
Oh
at each
man,
other.
Like right.
they're just a little like there's nothing grounding. That's why I mean that's why in so many of these movies they get their little masks ripped off and stuff, mm-hmm. right? Is because then you can have it feel a little more like there's a person yeah. there and
oh,
it's
look,
not just
there
two
are people, not just
two
action figures smashing.
yeah, it is. I didn't like the name. I know it's in the comics, but I thought that name is not a name that Shuri would come up with for it either. It just seems
it
like
really it was not
it no. necessary because
no, it's,
I would
it's like Shuri, oh, you're such an engineer.
Yeah.
You may be an incredible designer, but a marketing agent, you are not.
I guess.
The CGI's, I don't know if this is just Marvel overload or what at this point, but I didn't see this movie in the theater. I waited until it was out on Disney Plus. I find myself kind of watching the CGI fight scenes at like 1.5 speed.
Yeah.
Because I yeah. just, as far as I'm concerned, the most interesting stuff in the movies is when the characters are talking to each other and
yes.
not fighting at each other. Like,
yeah.
To me, the most powerful scenes, there's the whole pre Marvel Chiron grief sequence, which we just won't even get into, but like when Queen Ramonda calls out the elders in council and she's like, look, all of you fell in line behind Killmonger. M'Baku is literally the only person who stayed loyal to the idea of Wakanda and backed us in that fight, and don't think I haven't forgotten. I was like, oh
yeah,
that was a great scene, for example. Or Letitia Wright carried so much of this movie, and the expository scenes, even you know, the deep state fun couple conversations were kind of hilarious. And then you get to the fighting and I'm like, oh good, it's people who have never been constrained by gravity and they're apparently never hurt when they get hit, and now they're also blue, hooray. I found myself bored. Like, the action sequences aren't fun.
I agree with you, and in fact, I think, I mean, one of the challenges in having a movie that is kind of about a lot of ideas, and then also clashes of culture and things mm-hmm. like that, is there are the moments where it feels very much like, okay, we need to pay the bills now by having a big giant action sequence.
Yeah,
and I realize that people don't go to pay to see a Marvel movie to just have people talk and stuff, and that there's this feeling like you've got to give them their money's worth by having that 10-minute long action sequence at the end, and the other one that's slightly smaller that's in the middle, and in order to sort of pace out these big fight sequences. But like, yeah. I felt it more in this movie than I think any Marvel movie, and especially I wanted to call out what I think is one of the weakest things in this movie, which is at the end of the movie, two things happen, right? It is the clash of civilizations, because Wakanda is going to strike back at Talokan, and they're gonna you know, resolve this issue that's going on between these two peoples. And there are two things happening simultaneously. One of them is a fight between Shuri and Namor, which is, not only are they fighting in an interesting style, but it is a clash. It is a clash of their ideas against each other. It is an internal struggle that Shuri is having about whether she is going to go down the path of vengeance or not. All of that is super rich and interesting, and I'd say that her fight with Namor is interesting. Meanwhile, everybody from both countries has gone out to a boat that's in the middle of nowhere, in the negative space of the open ocean, and things are blowing up real good out there. And that part of it, I was like, I could not be less interested in these zero stakes, empty explosions in the middle of the ocean on a boat I don't care about, when the other part is the entire theme of your movie. It's not like the fight on the boat was like, oh, I see what they're doing. They're really representing the clash of ideas. No, not really. No. It was a bunch of punches and explosions and stuff.
But they got a whale.
And what a contrast. And this is what I'm saying, is what a contrast to what's going on between Neymar and Shuri on the beach.
Between two angry orphans frozen in this moment of tremendous rageful loss. And they're fighting.
Actually your climax of the movie where all your themes come together. But the other part, I'm like, I guess it's a Marvel movie. You gotta, but I found it completely boring. Mm-hmm. It was just completely boring to me.
It was, but I thought the vibe was different, like with the action stuff in these. Because like I knew, and I know that that's not like, I mean, that's not the greatest thing to have. Is like, oh well, it, you know, feels different. But like the whole thing on the bridge when Shuri and Okoye are trying to figure out like, who are they? What is their deal? How do we defend ourselves? And all of this, you know, like that whole thing was terribly interesting to me to watch them sort of, you know, trying to work it out and watch the blue people come out from underneath the bridge like, hi, you know, no riddles, just fighting, you know. And it was so, like, to me, that was the part, like, the fighting of it wasn't interesting. What was happening there was interesting. And, like, when they, you know, like, that whole sequence from the garage out, to me, was really interesting. And then the whole thing at the end was really interesting, like you said, Jason. But, you know, like, not because of the fighting that was fighting, you know. And I'm like, bored. And then, you know, here comes the movie. But we have a whale.
Yep.
Still bored. You know, it wasn't,
if you have a whale,
like, that
you're
part
still
wasn't
bored.
Oh no, they're attacking the
like
boat.
Yeah, see, like,
I guess.
Oh boy.
Oh, that, okay.
That,
like, what I want,
darn,
like, I, you know, like, I kind of want to find out how Namor and his people feel about dolphins, like, on a side note. But like, you know, you've dragooned whales into this, and why? Like, there's not much of a payoff other than, oh, look, CGI.
That's cool.
They look
that,
cool.
That third act, that third act battle, made me groan from inception. Because you know, so here we are. We have the triumphant moment where we finally figure out who the Black Panther is going to be. It is Shuri. She is recreated, you know.
And Killmonger appears, right? Which is like,
she did the thing.
I didn't expect that, right?
No,
like, who's
no.
in the chair? It's going to be Mom. It
Not
can't be Chadwick Boseman. Yeah. What are they going to do? And it's like, no.
Y'all, I screamed.
Screw you, everybody. It's just Killmonger, and he is here. He is here to be the devil.
Right.
Oh my God.
But he's right. Like, even from beyond the grave, he is right. Like,
that's the,
like,
crazy part. The crazy part about that was the second time watching it, it was like, oh, holy crap. He's right again.
Yeah.
Right? Like
he's
right
and, some more.
So
yeah.
Like, that was, you know, all of that was great. You
Huge
have this
peak, yeah.
You have this great moment with her and M'Baku in their land, and it was all, you know, all of that was great. But she's like, all right, here's the plan, guys. We've got to strike Namor, and we've got to defeat these guys. Where should we do it?
How about in the ocean? In the middle of the ocean?
And yeah, how about in the ocean? In there, in the house?
We got a boat.
Wait, what?
We haven't seen right. the Wakandan Navy yet. Let's see the Wakandan Navy. There's,
like,
another thing
to
design.
The best place to fight a shark is on the land. Duh. So I was just like, ugh. And you knew that's,
like, how many members of the Wakandan fighting forces had to die
right.
for
and
for,
that was, you know, that was the crazy part. Is like, so, you know, here we are, we get to the climax, Shuri has saved everyone, and they come back under the banner of peace, the Bloods and the Crips are holding their bandanas together, and you've got the ship, and there's like 5 Wakandans left. Like, all of the Wakandans have died. Who are they? Like,
it's the whole Wakanda Navy has been lost now.
Who are they
saving? Who did you say? Yes.
The Wakanda Navy fits in a Wakanda.
And the whole fight
at this point
is like, it's just terrible. Well, this fight is pointless because regardless of what happens here, they're going to settle it, right? The two of them are going to settle it.
Right.
So, and it wasn't, yeah. And again, yeah, it was also not adding any, like, I could see how there could be layers added where it's like, well, it's actually kind of interesting because, but there's none of that. It really is just that they're fighting out there. I wanted to mention, so Moises mentioned Ironheart earlier, Riri Williams, nice new character from the comics that they brought in here. She's really interesting. She's the genius who comes up with the whole thingamajig that sets this whole plot going on.
Jason, you could say that she's a real genius.
You could. You could, but more of an MIT
she
type.
Created
if you
a thing.
Me.
It's a Wakandan
that's
village
right, that the government takes and uses.
She oh, that the government yes, takes
right.
to use for their
you're,
own
you're
purposes.
You're absolutely right. It's a real Project Crossbow kind of situation there. So, but I wanted to throw in here that in this fight,
see now I want that. Now I want this SFX to do a deep fake of Val Kilmer as somebody
as her professor.
Clearly. I just want to know what she says when she wires yeah. up somebody's braces with radio.
So
reception.
We see her in this. Mm-hmm. She has been. There's a montage. Speaking of the 80s and real genius, there is actually a montage where Shuri and Riri
so
invent
much.
Things. For a while, which is kind of fun, and then the Midnight Angel happens. So again, love a montage. But then we get the fight, and she's in her full on Ironheart suit. And here's my complaint: it's not using Riri Williams because I actually think that having her in the movie is great. My problem is that I know that they're going to do an Ironheart TV show, right? And I feel like they've stolen the moment from Riri Williams here because she goes to Wakanda and there's a montage and she invents the suit. And then at the end, they're like, we're going to send you back to the U.S., but you can't take your magic suit with you because you'll need to build a new one in your Disney Plus TV series that's coming next year. And that part just really frustrated me because it's like you're kind of short-circuiting this character in order to let her fly around in this boat
start.
Scene that you're doing, and it just made me madder about the boat fight at the end. That's all I wanted to say about it. She's a great character. It's fun. I'm glad that she's the impetus for the plot. I think it's a great way to introduce her to the story, but I was a little frustrated that they get the super snazzy suit on her and then take it away because she's going to have to do that again on her own TV show.
Get that
I
suit
guess.
Back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the Peter Parker effect. Right, he had to do the exact same thing.
Yeah,
that's totally true. Oh,
I saw this opening weekend in the theater, and as soon as Shuri ended up in the throne room and walked around the throne, and Killmonger was sitting there, I couldn't help myself, and I leaned over to my friend, and I went, "Lisa is going to freak out," and I was so excited, like on your behalf, that was happening. Like, even before he said a word, I just knew how thrilled you would be, and I just wanted to, share that with you.
Like, oh, you know, my gosh,
that
yes.
was the first thing that came to mind, because he was, like you said, he was right from beyond the grave,
yes.
you know?
Yes, yeah. You know I was on Etsy looking for Killmonger as Rate Mugs.
I know.
I love that when Shuri went and had her visit with Killmonger, he points out that she's acting from a place of confusion because she's only doing half of the job. Because he points out, you know, your mother died to protect a member of our lost tribe. Don't you dare take that from her. And then he's like, okay, now let's burn it to the ground. And I like how he brings it back to the theme of what responsibility does Wakanda have to the rest of the world? And then what responsibility do you have to Wakanda? Because Shuri's whole thing has always been, I'm a genius. I get to do a lot of stuff because I'm royalty. And this is the film where it's like, okay, you were given a lot of gifts, but now comes the time you have to pay. Like, what is the price you're willing to pay for them? And I just friggin' love that Killmonger is the one who frames it in those terms. And more importantly, gives her that frame of reference where when she does have that final confrontation with Namor, and you have that really lovely flashback sequence where you mm-hmm. see their mothers and you see the histories that they're carrying
and how they rhyme.
Well, but you know, none of that would have been possible without Killmonger explicitly talking about her mom the whole time. And to be honest, that kind of gives me a little bit of hope for him too, where if he can understand, he's sort of groping towards enlightenment. Maybe he'll get through another couple of millennia. But I love that Ryan Coogler gives so many characters so much space to make really good points and then trusts the audience to have to sit with all that and say, okay, you know, say what you will about the tenets of Killmonger.
Yeah.
Murdering fields of people.
At least it's an ethos.
Yeah, right? And I love that Namor's a king. He's not a bad guy. He's playing like centuries long chess. And was I like a little bit uncomfortable that there's a lot of conflict between, you know, two people who are both fighting to stay out of a really colonialist globe? Yes. Yes, I was. And I'm kind of glad I was uncomfortable about that. But at the same time, I also think it's great that the stories are getting more nuanced, where you can see both points of view, and then Killmonger comes in and goes, oh, and then consider this. You're like, oh, thank you. I will. Well,
and it allows Shuri to have that moment where she's sort of like thinking about Killmonger's words and thinking about her mother and then comparing herself to Namor. And it's like, mm-hmm. How am I like this guy? How am I not like this guy? Because that's part of the whole thing is the comparison. It's like, these are two similar peoples on similar paths. I do have a feeling that on rewatch, it's like, Namor's been waiting and biding his time about the surface world, but like, I think he's kind of panicked here a little bit, right? Like, I think that's what has happened here is the revelation of Wakanda existing has panicked him because he's like, oh no, he knows immediately we're going to get found out and it's going to happen again. Like it happened to our ancestors and so I got to do something about this. And he lashes out at Wakanda because Wakanda brought up the subject of vibranium and therefore exposed them unwittingly. And it is, and what makes Namor Namor is that his response is like I said earlier, it's like, if you don't agree, I will attack you first of the whole world. I'll attack you first. And it's like, dude, that was not the right thing to do, but that is the kind of stuff that Shuri has to weigh when she's looking at him and fighting him and saying, do I want to be like this guy? Do I want to have Killmonger whispering in my ear, or do I want to listen to my mom? And like, that's the richness of it. That's the richness of this story that makes it so great.
Well, and the thing I love about it is all the power, right? Like, you know, I mean, to go back to, you know, a classic law of Marvel Comics, right? With great power comes great responsibility. And if you're Namor, you react to that one way, you know, when the responsibility is for all of your people. And when you're Shuri, you react to that exact same kind of responsibility in a different way, because they're both kind of having to deal with the same thing, which is the world knows about vibranium. And what do I, you know, and somebody found out about me, and what am I going to do about that? And then, you know, and then you've got, you know, the Contessa who walks in and goes, yeah, I've got great power, great responsibility, pass. And then, and, you know, and then just continues to fling hand grenades around along behind her everywhere she goes, which I think is fantastic, but it's also another way to look at great power, great responsibility. What do we do here? And that was part of what I thought was interesting throughout all of the movie, was how everybody reacted to it was kind of thrust upon all of them at some point. And what do I do about this? And watching everybody come to terms with that was really interesting throughout the film.
Can we talk about Letitia Wright and the dichotomy between her performance in the first film and this film, right? Like, I mean, just not a care in the world in the first film, even when the stakes were super high. And, you know, she was about her business. Mm-hmm. She did her thing, but she was perfectly fine sitting in the background and not having the responsibility or the burden of leadership and just having that mantle thrust upon her, both as the character and as the actor. Being able to see both of those things happen in this film, and the way that she was able to handle all of that was incredible. Now, the question that I have, based on everything that we've seen, you know, including the post-credit scene, is, do we believe that Shuri will be the Black Panther in many subsequent films? You know, the Black Panther 3, well, she'll definitely or presumably will be the Black Panther, but going into the new Avengers or going into whatever phase 5 and 6 or, you know, whatever those
that
are.
That Thunderbolts movie or whatever is whatever else they're sending. I think so. I think it's interesting that they have M'Baku's going to be the king, but she's going to be the Black Panther, and that's going to be the dynamic. But, you know, I was watching the Marvel, whatever they call it.
Assembled.
They're assembled about this movie. And one of the things that really struck me was, I think it was Ryan Coogler said, you know, we didn't cast Letitia Wright to be the Black Panther, right? Like, we didn't plan this, and that she had to really rise to the challenge of doing stuff in water and doing lots of choreographed fight scenes and all, and carrying the emotional and physical burden of being this character that she really didn't sign up to be in the original. I have a question about sort of like, on the one hand, this feels very essential to the Marvel Cinematic Universe in that we're really setting up a geopolitical situation that I don't know how they would resolve it other than, you know, is it in a different movie or is it in a third Black Panther movie? And the only reason that I'm not sure that they'll resolve it in some other movie is mostly because when you look at the rest of the Marvel movies right now, they seem to be focused on multiverses and time travel and all sorts of cosmic weird stuff, and not like a potential world war between superpowers, including two you've never heard of before, one of which is underwater, right? Like, that seems important, right? It seems important. It was apparently important to Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her boss, the president.
And her former husband. Surprise!
Yes, exactly. So my question, Cicero, is I feel like, yes, absolutely, we're going to see this Black Panther again, and we're going to see. But my question is, like, where? And does it continue to be kind of, I mean, there's lots of advantages to these films feeling like they're part of the MCU, but not so much that they get to kind of interact. But there does come a point where you're like, but what about Talokan, everybody? Like, can we just ignore Talokan? Because I don't think we can.
Like that Thunderbolts movie is going to be real interesting with Thunderbolt Ross as the president of the United States.
Harrison Ford, as Thunderbolt Ross.
Get off my plane. Well, I think I've already figured out the plot of Black Panther 3. The Americans, the U.S. government, in their efforts to try and invade and take down Wakanda, reach out to this Eastern European government. The government of Latveria.
Latveria.
And Latveria!
It's another country we haven't ever heard of that's important.
And they team up with Latveria to attack Wakanda.
I mean, Namor is a big Fantastic Four character, so I do wonder if maybe there's some plans on that level. But the Thunderbolts...
He's a bigger Fantastic Four character to some members of the Fantastic Four than others.
Yeah, I love how he's just a thorn in the side of Reed Richards. Right. Sue Storm should be mine!
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and can we talk for a second about how this is the first time we heard the word mutant word in a Marvel
one time
movie?
Well, it's the first time we've heard it in the movies, because we heard it in a TV show. Kelly, remember?
I think they said that Kamala Khan was a mutation.
No, they tippy-toed around something. They tippy-toed all the way up to the edge of mutant and looked way over the edge,
and then we're like of some sort, but here he's just like, I'm a mutant, and it's like, all right, they're just laying that out there too. No, there's a lot there's a lot out there. It's just funny when like there's all the Ant-Man hype around as we record this multiverse and Kang, and they're going to do all this stuff. It's like, okay, all right, we'll see what that is. And then you look at Wakanda Forever and you're like, but meanwhile, on planet Earth, where we all live, this is happening.
Which
all
is of us infinitely are. Interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But again, I'm also kind of happy that the Black Panther movies are only very, very, very lightly connected to the rest of the MCU.
Yeah. They're like MCU in law, kind of.
I feel like it's a vacation from the MCU in some way. Like, they're just so beautifully realized. Yeah. The world building is astonishing. Like, I could go back and look at Ruth Carter's costumes for forever.
Costumes are staggering.
I mean, the disruptive thing that they could do is they've set up that, oh, there's going to be further conflict between these nations. But if, you know, we've got a movie called Secret Wars coming. There's all this Kang and multiverse stuff going on. The enemy of your enemy is your friend kind of stuff, heading off a, you know, like we've seen Talokan and Wakanda fight. Do we really need to see these people, that avoided colonization? Well, one of them, fled colonization. Do we really need to see them brutalize each other, or would it be better for them to look at a teaching moment, a learning opportunity, a way to avoid that entirely? That's what I would want.
There's just that moment you talk about how it's slightly different from, I mean, it's just like MCU, but not too much. There's a moment in the movie where it's pointed out, like, oh, you know, T'Challa didn't even kill his father's killer. And I'm like, oh, what was... Oh, right, Zemo. Right. And I'm like, what? Zemo. Like, I mean, I know Black Panther appears first in Civil War, and like, but I had that moment where I'm like, oh, wow, suddenly I'm remembering a whole other set of characters that I haven't been thinking about while watching Wakanda Forever. But they're all kind of part of the same thing. So, okay, all right, fine.
Yeah. I went back actually and rewatched the scene in Civil War where T'Challa confronts Zemo. I went back and watched it today so I'd be kind of fresh about it and to see if there were a lot of beat for beat type of things. And also because the critique were, oh, T'Challa's too noble. And what I really loved about
Angela Bassett would like to tell you, you can never be too noble.
Yeah, but what I loved about when he's like, vengeance has consumed you, and those jack wagons who are busy fighting in the super secret Soviet facility. I don't want to be like you all. And also, I'm a king. I know better. I was raised better. Like, he doesn't say that, but it's like implied very heavily where he's like, I'm done. I have better things to do. There's an entire nation to run. And then he deprives Zemo of committing suicide. And that note of canniness that he brings to it is something that, you know, when Shuri clearly makes her alliance with M'Baku, at the end of the movie, when Namor is telling Namora, oh, you know, eventually Shuri will have to turn to me, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I want to see how he's going to deal with M'Baku as the king of Wakanda, because that's a whole different conversation. Like, they don't have the Dead Dad's Club in common. Like, they're going to have to find another way to chit chat.
Yes.
You're not that different, you and me. I also like to wear dead animals as clothing.
And tiny shorts.
We could get along here, and I. It's going to be... It's
oh, fish be man.
Everyone can wear tiny shorts together in harmony.
In harmony. Tiny shorts and dead animals. I mean, really... First of all, who among us? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what more do you need, really? Tiny shorts and dead
Team
animals.
M'Baku is what I'm saying. So I need to, get us back to so there's, this movie has like three different endings, and I think it's good. They break Ross out of the transport van. That's the colonizer in chains. Now we've seen everything. And then we go back to Haiti, and Shuri comes to do that final goodbye ritual that she refused to do with her mother. And so Naki is there, but she goes and wants to do it herself. And she goes down on the beach and she burns the robe. And most of the credits start to roll over the burning of the robe. It's a very nice moment. And again, this is that moment where we get a little more space for all of us, everybody involved, including the audience, to mourn, whether it's T'Challa or Chadwick Boseman or both. There's the space for mourning. And then the movie does the thing where they say, oh, so the robe is finished burning now. Here's Nakia and that kid who showed Angela Bassett where she was in the beginning. Oh, that's her son, Toussaint. Okay, well, that's very nice. He's like, no, that's just my Haitian name. I'm actually Prince T'Challa. My father was King T'Challa. And the crying begins at that point and continues through the rest of the credits. And it just is that final little cherry on top of like the It is the, we have given you time to mourn. We have watched the robe burn. And now in this emotional moment, we're also going to have this realization that, oh yeah, that your mom didn't tell you some stuff. And life goes on. And this is his son. And he is the, you know, basically the heir to the throne. And it's just, I loved it. It's just such a wonderful moment of to leave the movie on.
I cry through the entire movie, right?
There are a lot of points, yeah, but this is the one that gets me the hardest.
I cried through the entire movie.
Something about that.
You know, the movie basically bookended, or, you know, it the bookends were Chadwick Boseman's last T'Challa. And you know, what a beautiful way to end it with Letitia Wright just kind of looking off into, and I want to say Letitia Wright and not Shuri, right? Because it felt like Letitia Wright was celebrating and grieving her brother in arms in this film franchise in Chadwick Boseman, and not her brother, you know, Shuri's brother T'Challa. And I felt like I was there doing the exact same thing for everything that he represented, both within this franchise and for the culture. Because this, you know, this is a person that, and I have not said it here, but this is a guy who played for Black folks, all of our heroes, both real and imagined, right? He played, you know, the Black Panther, but he was also James Brown and Jackie Robinson, yeah, and Thurgood Marshall.
Jackie
right?
Robinson.
Like he was good friend all Marshall. Of our heroes, and he did it with grace, and he was noble, right? He was everything that T'Challa was, or that people tried to denigrate T'Challa for being. He was all of those things: graceful, noble, regal. And he's gone. And we, you know, so we all got to celebrate that with Letitia Wright at the end. And it was beautiful. And I was bawling. And then the end credit scenes come. And, you know, like all my tissues are gone. All my napkins are gone. I've cried in my popcorn, right? There's no space for anything. And then Ryan Coogler does this thing. And he's like, oh, yeah. Here's his son, and his son has his name.
Yeah.
And here, now sit with that, you idiot. Right? And, you know, right? And then it was like there was like puddles on the ground in the theater. It was ridiculous. So beautifully done.
Oh man,
so beautifully done.
My experience of seeing it the first time, I have to relate, because here's what happened. So the ceremonial clothes burned. Here's the kid. His name is T'Challa, Prince T'Challa, son of T'Challa. Power goes out.
Oh.
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 Power comes back on. Well, we sit there for 25 minutes, all of us in this auditorium going, I'm not leaving. Like, let us know when you get it back to where it needs to be. And they apparently, like, it fried something on that projector specifically, such that they literally had to set it up on a different screen. And they were like, hey, we have it all queued up. Thank you so much for waiting. Here's a little voucher for all of you. And I was like, okay, good, great. We watched the rest of the movie. And then as we're walking out, I take a look at the vouchers and I'm like, cool, I got a free movie pass. And it was a free popcorn.
What?
I was like, no.
And then you cried again.
Not enough. To quote the great Cicero Holmes from about 2 minutes ago, sit with that, you idiot.
Sit with that, you idiot.
So what I've learned is that I need to take Cicero to the movies with me, because I go to we normally go to a theater that has, like, they do the nice meal and stuff, like, as part of the experience. And so they have, like, really nice cloth napkins. And my friend it was his second time through. And this is where we saw Endgame, where as soon as the movie started, he went out and got like three of those and came back in to sit with me, because he and I have ever been to a movie together. And so, so that's what we'll do, is you can just come see it with me next time. And we'll get those
Thank you.
Cloth napkins and just be a complete disaster, and it'll be fine.
Yeah. Ring them out
while you're crying into your hamburger or whatever. You can.
Right.
What? I mean, like, I don't know. Is there anything else that we should touch on that we haven't yet? I mean, there's a lot here. And it is a long movie. I feel like we've covered a lot of the main things. I wanted to mention, because I didn't mention him by name, Tenochtitlan Mejia, who is that is, I mean, if you had said to me, oh, they're going to do a namer on the screen, I'd be like, good luck. Like, good luck. He's like, yeah. Imagine like Mr. Spock, but like on a really bad day. And yet he does. And with all the world building they do around him, but like, he does a good job. I really like that character. I think he is super charismatic, which he needs to be, and believable with, again, including the bad things he does, like agree with us or we destroy you, right? Like, it's like, all right, come on, dude. But like, right. A really fun, good performance by him, an actor who I hadn't seen in anything before, and I thought he did a great job.
Yeah, I think this was his like kind of like big screen introduction. Yeah. So what I really enjoyed, or what I thought was clever, was the entomology of his name.
I did like that. Right?
Like that wasn't, that was, you know, that was something that, you know, he was just Namor the Submariner, as far as I knew, you know, in the comics. But the way to like really tie all of that stuff in together,
the child was, without love,
really clever.
Mm-hmm.
Love, yes.
That was I mean, they had to do it, right? They had to figure something out.
For many of us in the Latin community, that was always kind of it was sort of a baked into things sort of deal. Like Diego Luna has said that you know, in Mexico, R2-D2's Arturito, little Arthur.
Yeah.
And to me, it's, you know, it was Star Wars, but in my household, it was Star Wars. And Namor, I always thought he was of Latin extraction as a kid. I was like, wow, well, there's this guy, and then depending on who draws him, Doctor Strange.
See now the title of Los Spookies makes so much more sense.
See, there you go.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I think Namor is such a great contrast to Shuri too, because when you think about it, even though Shuri says in this movie, I just buried the last person who truly knew me, one of the things that really shines through in both movies is how love and devotion are just integral to existing as a Wakandan. I mean, there aren't a whole lot of Wakandan lone wolves. Everybody is part of a bigger community and they feel supported, and in turn they offer and extend that support. And you contrast that with the violent origins of Namor's nation and how those very fundamental bonds are disrupted. And it just gets really interesting, because Wakanda would have been a much different place if they had ever had to deal with colonizers. Just like one of the appeals of Wakanda is, this is what happens when colonizers don't get to you. I sort of feel like the whole point of this movie is, look at the damage that gets done. Look at the damage that gets baked in from the inception of nations when you do this. Look at how hard it is to get over this sort of thing when people are not raised in a community or a place where they are allowed to feel safe and feel loved. And like I said, I don't really see Namor as a bad guy in this at all. And I love and adore how the power of community and connections and family and love is something that is embodied by all of the Wakandans over and over again, even if they come after you with spears. It's just such a beautifully realized, it's a better culture, I think, than a lot of the other ones that we've been exposed to in the MCU, or they've tried to build out. Like, the world building here really is just next level.
I bet you with spears or with those like taser dagger things too.
You brought a spear in here?
Taser daggers, yeah.
Honestly. I think what I liked about this movie, like on a meta level and with individual characters and with individual relationships and how things ultimately end up, is that everything sort of felt like a third way. Like, we made a movie about this dude, Black Panther, and now we can't use him anymore. And what do we do with that? And they found this other way. And you know, what does Shuri end up doing? You know, she doesn't need to be the ruler and also Black Panther. And so she found another way. And all of the things that happened, like getting this movie made, couldn't be, well, we're just going to recast Black Panther. Like, that was just never on the table. There was no way that was ever going to be anything that anyone was going to seriously consider. So, you know, they couldn't do that. And they couldn't just, and a thing, one of the small things I appreciated so much about this was that they didn't try to do one of those like recut footage or, you know, CGI him into something unnecessarily.
Princess Leia him.
We didn't have T'Challa pulling up in a Dodge Charger next to M'Baku salute him.
There was no, you know, Grand Moff T'Challa, like, you know, staring at us from the depths of a CGI machine. So like all of the, like they always found this third way to be able to do the thing, you know. Shuri at the end finds a third way to exist with Namor. She finds a third way to be Black Panther but doesn't necessarily have to rule, and the movie found a third way to do the thing they needed to do. And all of the things about how things evolve throughout the film, how everybody decides everything, how everybody works with each other, all ends up being kind of this third way. And that's one of the things that I appreciated the most about all of it once Cicero and I were done crying, was that all of that happened. And because of that, you can feel the love and the care and the effort that everybody puts into it. Because, you know, Cicero, like you were saying, like Letitia Wright did not sign up to be the main character in the Black Panther. And just like Shuri did not ever sign up to be the Black Panther. Like, that was never going to be her lot in life. And that was exactly the same thing that happened to the actors. And, you know, the movie we were supposed to have, you know, this is one of those things that people, I can't argue against when people say maybe this is the darkest timeline, is that we only got one movie with Chadwick Boseman as Black Panther, you know, one Black Panther movie with him as Black Panther. And, you know, he's sprinkled in to other things. I mean, like, that's really, you know, my favorite thing in What If is that we get a little bit of him there for a little while. And I cried through that too. So those, like, all of those, like, all of the things about this were part of why I thought it was so interesting. And then I think that's part of why the third reel fight scene stands out the way it does, is because that's such a standard thing. And they took this standard thing and stuck it in this movie that is all about not doing the obvious thing.
That's a really good point, where there's that disconnect.
Yeah, I think that's, I think, the second time I watched it, I think that was the thing that sat with me, was like, isn't it interesting how they found everybody has this other solution that was not the obvious solution to do the thing they needed to do. And then it worked for everything except the third reel.
I don't know, that boat, watch out. Exciting stuff happening on that boat. All right. This has been a great conversation about a movie that I enjoyed a lot for a lot of reasons, except for I didn't even get into the why the UN is meeting in a hotel conference room somewhere, but it's a weird choice.
United Nations, okay. Airport Ramada.
Yeah, it's, you know, a little weird, but, you know, okay,
someone,
whatever.
Someone leased the building during the staff. They can't get out of the legal arrangement.
I got to riff on the boat. I don't need to go too far deep into the hotel United Nations conference center. Anyway, thank you to all my panelists for being here to talk about Wakanda Forever. Cicero Holmes, thank you.
Wakanda Forever.
Indeed. Lisa Schmeiser, thank you.
Thank you for having me again. I really loved being on this podcast with everybody here.
Hey, Kelly Gamont, thank you.
I can be discreet. Is it the makeup? It's the wrong shade, isn't it?
No, it's the right shade. It's the right shade. It's fine. No, it's and Moises Chuyon, thank you.
I'd hang around longer, but I got to go get my septum pierced.
And thanks to everybody out there. I know you all were waiting for us to talk about that big movie with all the special effects that involves blue people and lots of water. We did it. We did it.
Yes, it's, we did it.
We found a third way. This is the water.
So good. All right, that's it. Those are the jokes, folks. See you next time on The Incomparable. Bye.